Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the next episode of the True Turf Super Series. Very pleased today to introduce a man who's in one of the best locations in the world, I think, for golf, and that's in the Monterey area, Pebble Beach. And that is Mike Noel, the course superintendent at Del Monte Golf Course in California. Mike, welcome along today.
How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing really well. And as I said, I'm a bit envious, even though I always tell people that I think living here in the Gold Coast in Australia is one of the best places in the world. I do have a very soft spot for that Monterey and California area as well. So we'll look enviously at each other as we talk about our locations in life. So, but thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. And this conversation has been born out, I suppose, of us looking at our social media contacts and the talk out in the industry. One thing from True Turf is that we like to look at talking about sustainability, the sustainability of rolling the turf that we manage. But we also feel there's another important conversation to be had out there. And that's the sustainability of the people that work in the industry and maintain the grass that people get to enjoy. So we've certainly, through Anna from my marketing team, had a connection with you to understand your story, I suppose, and how you're helping people out in the industry to look after themselves as well, because it's a really important thing that we need to do.
Absolutely. We need to show ourselves the same attention that we show our equipment and our golf courses. And that's a crusade that I'm more than happy to champion.
Absolutely. Well, we are too, and very happy to join you in this crusade, we'll call it. But the opportunity for our customers, but for the wider industry, and I've been in the golf industry for 25 years now, and I've certainly seen many different facets of that along the way, from club management to association level. And the challenges we all put on ourselves to achieve, all the expectations that are put on us to achieve, sometimes can be a little bit like climbing Mount Everest, I suppose. But we just need to be able to take that step back for a bit of, as you say, I think, self-reflection, and ensure that we're looking after ourselves and making sure that we come to work wanting to be there, but also knowing that there are support mechanisms behind us as well to help us achieve and get on with life.
Absolutely.
Mm. So tell us a bit about your start, because you started more in a corporate career and found some challenges with that. What was your early start with the love of turf, I suppose, and led you into a life in golf?
I think my early love of turf was that Dad liked to mow the yard, and he took great pride in it. I'm a middle child, and my brother is a junior. No, my brother's the third. So,
yep.
You know, he's the apple of the eye, and I'll do anything I can to get time with Dad when I was younger. And it was a matter of going out and helping in the yard. And we're talking like tyke size. We're talking 3, 4, 5 years old of like the earliest memories. And my dad coming home from trips. And I remember he brought the little lawnmower and the little Fisher Price weed eater, and I got to do it just like him. And you know, you fast forward a couple years, and he was pretty avid in the golf. He liked the golf. But you know, he was a municipal public golf courses. We weren't part of a club or anything, but he played, he helped put on golf tournaments for charity organizations, and you know, he tried mowing a green across the street from our house in the big lot. And that was weeds. There was no desirable turf over there. Like if I look back, like we were just mowing something at a half an inch, and some of it was bare, some of it was broadleaf, some of it was warm season turf. It was a plot of green vegetation, and it was shorter than everything else, and you could chip on it and everything. And that's the earliest memories. And from there, my father taught me that I could make money mowing grass. We didn't necessarily have the financial stability or excess like some of my friends or family. And I learned that if I mowed a neighbor's yard, that I could earn some money. I personally loved mowing the yard and making it look good. It was immediate gratification. And that grew over the years. I put myself through high school, through college, built up a nice sized business. And everyone back then knew that I loved to mow grass. All friends, all family, they'd hire me. And it was a situation where I had a love for the turf, but I started creating relationships. And one thing that I look back upon and is happening now in the golf world, those relationships. I had relationships with family members that we didn't see all the time. But guess what? I was at their house every single week because I was mowing their yard. Yeah. So I built relationships with aunts, uncles, cousins, neighbors, because we saw each other and we would talk about life. We'd know what was going on. And that was a bright spot in my life. I never said that I worked. Everyone asked me what I did for work. And it's like, I don't work. I mow grass. I never looked at it as a job. It's really weird. Like I remember saying that all the time. And people knew that about me. So that was where my real love came for turf. I ended up creating that business all the way through college. Graduated right after Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. And Hurricane Katrina was in New Orleans, Louisiana. It caused some crazy damage and, I mean, catastrophic damage all across the city. And I was able to sell my business, and I graduated from college with a finance and an economics degree. And the unwritten rules, the speak underneath the breath was, you can't mow grass the rest of your life. Like, you just went to like this great school. You should use that degree and go become a professional and make lots of money and become somebody. And I took that. And part of that is just the schooling in general. You know, I got an economics and a finance degree. That's what I was going to go do, right? So I sold the business and then I got into the corporate world. And I was living in a condo in San Francisco. The whole maintaining a yard, there are no yards in San Francisco the way they are down south in Louisiana. And I even thought about it, like, how could I do something on the side? And it's just completely different. There's no maintenance of actually having to mow yards in San Francisco. Most of them don't have turf, you know, and if they do, it doesn't grow the same way it grows in southern Louisiana, where it's, you know, if you neglect it for 2 weeks, you got 2 feet high St. Augustine. Yeah. So I got in the corporate world and very ambitious, very aggressive. Like, I'm here to change the world. This young 22-year-old that I am the definition of the original millennial. I thought I should have been paid six figures out of college. I thought that I should be the boss when I got there. And since I wasn't, I was going to prove to everyone that I should be the boss and I should be getting paid that big money. And they loved it. I came with enthusiasm. This business had no enthusiasm. And I made a mark for myself. I ended up moving up the ranks pretty quickly. And then over the last, eight and a half years that I was there, I moved a bunch of different offices, taking over financially failing offices and improving them, like, greatly. The first district I took over was completely in the red. They were ready to close it down. And within months, we flipped that thing and it was the top producer on the West Coast at the time. And they saw that. So I stayed with them and was doing all that, but it wasn't fulfilling. It was definitely self-driven for title, for money, for status. And then once those goals were reached, it was like what's next? Just more. And that was not fulfilling. And through that whole time, I was battling with alcoholism. I didn't know I was battling with alcoholism. I thought I was just a boy from southern Louisiana, New Orleans to be specific, that liked to drink. Everyone drinks in New Orleans. I mean, it's a cultural thing. Drugs are bad, but alcohol is good. As long as you got your work on your bills. As long as you treated people correctly, drink as much as you want. I knew religious people that drank a lot like that back home. They were great priests. I knew businessmen. I knew police officers. They were great people. They did a lot of charity work. They were great to the family. They treated everybody wonderful, but they drank every day. And that was just, it was normal. Mm. So I didn't think it was a problem. And then it became a problem. And we all knew it was a problem. I was the last one to find out, which is so funny. And it was a long battle. Years of going to doctors, different psychologists, different psychiatrists, and none of that working. And then finally, I ended up getting sober a year before I pretty much got out of the career. And I thought that was going to help. I thought I was going to be more, my mind was going to be freer. I was going to be better at what I did. And I quickly found out that that alcohol was the medicine that I needed to deal with that, that career. I just wasn't built for it.
Yep. Yeah. But so it was giving that sort of security blanket, that was allowing you to function in something that you didn't find actually satisfying.
Yeah. Cause you can find out, I mean, you can put a round peg in a square hole if you got a mallet. Correct. It's real easy. You just stick it there and you just beat it through it. Right. That's what I was doing. Right. When I got sober, I was able to go through a lot of introspective writing, analyzing what was going on in my life, talking to others, creating a good prayer life, trusting God, going through all these different experiences. And I finally came to a crossroad where it's just like, this is not for me anymore. I am absolutely done. Doesn't matter what I do, but I'm not doing that. Like, you could offer me at that moment in time, and I'm super blessed and grateful that I got to that point of being in so much fear and so much pain that I was able to just walk away with nothing, right? And I quit. Didn't have anything to do. I just knew I wasn't doing that, and it was relieving. It was just, I pulled the ripcord, I jumped off the cliff, and started moving forward. And a couple different people, I got super emotional today thinking about it. So we have this great magazine article coming out, detailing my sobriety and mental health. And one of the men that was super pivotal in my career change, unfortunately passed within the last year to 18 months. And he is an absolute, just amazing man. Pretty big time corporate guy, like, and he was with me my whole journey, good friend of the family. And I'd always contact him when I had a resume, because he'd be one of my, I'm going blank on the word.
References.
Yep. Thank you.
Yep.
And I called his wife today, and I talked to her as if it was him. And I know them. This is funny now we're getting to this. I know them, and I had such a great relationship with them. I mowed their yard.
Yeah.
I mowed his yard. I mowed his parents' yard. I mowed their rental properties for a decade. They're great, great family friends. And I'm just coming to realization of that. And he always used me and always recommended me, but we built a relationship through that. And he asked me if I had all the money in the world, what would I do? I say, that's easy, Mr. Paul. And I get emotional and swelled up about it because it was such a simple question.
Yep.
That when you can look back in hindsight, that was the pivotal moment. Somebody asking such a simple question.
Yep.
And he wasn't the only one that asked that. There were two others. Very similar questions. And it was just like, dude, I'd build a golf course or a baseball field in my backyard, and I'd tend to it. Yeah. I'd be the happiest person on earth. Why don't you go do that, Michael? Money, status, all these different things. And it's just like, but you made money. you just made the most money you ever made this past year, and you were the most unhappy you've ever been in your life. You know, you were doing something you didn't want to do, and you were miserable, and you were stressed out, you were anxious, and you were depressed. Maybe it's not about money. Maybe it's not about the status. Maybe it's not about the title. Like, blot out everybody else. Who cares what other people think? Maybe do what you want to do and that you feel fulfilled doing. And that was enough of a catalyst to get me started to go to a golf course. I literally went to a golf course not knowing anyone. I pulled up and I found the superintendent and I introduced myself and I asked him if he'd be willing to teach me what he does so I can do what he does. And I was willing to work for free. Another person in the sobriety community told me, he's like, if you go and you offer to work for free, you're probably way more apt to take you on and let you work since they don't have to pay you. And we took the money aspect out of it completely and looked at the passion side of it. And I do, I have a passion for it. Mm-hmm. God just stuck me with the green thumb when it comes to turf. I literally love it. I don't know why. The smell of it, the way it looks when you're done, the way you can bring it back to life, all that kind of stuff. And I started working for this man, and this man realized I was serious. He was so dumbfounded when I showed up that day, because he called my references and found out that I did work in the corporate world, and I was exactly who I said I was, and I did make the money that I said I made, and this, that, and the other. And so he was just like, why? Like, you're crazy, kid. And he figured out that I was very serious. And he was a pivotal part of me getting into the industry and getting into schooling to get a turf certificate so that I could learn more and use whatever talents and abilities that I had to improve the industry. And that was huge. But to correlate it into the whole sobriety thing, you know, I'm a year sober while I was going through that. And it's funny, last night I was talking to somebody and he's got 24 days of sobriety and he's at work and he's talking about having his earbuds in and he's listening to these speakers that talk about sobriety. And I started laughing. I was like, man, I remember raking bunkers for 4 hours a morning, hand raking every single one on the golf course where I was. And I'd have my earbuds in, listen to speaker tapes of these people that told me what it was like when they were drunk, then what happened to get sober, and then what it was like today. And just engulfed into sobriety, being able to do that while I was just starting, created an environment that I loved. And then next thing you know, you start talking to people, and there's a lot of people in the industry that need help. They don't know they need help, all of them. But you get to be there. And of what I've learned in sobriety is being open and vulnerable and speaking just your story, just being vulnerable enough to be like, dude, listen to what I used to do. And, this is what happened. And all of a sudden they're willing. I mean, that same golf course that I got, funny story really quick. It's going to go on a tangent, but that same golf course where I got my start in the turf world is also the same golf course that I used to play.
Right.
And it brings back a memory. I was the type of guy, I'd go play, I'm supposed to be working, but I have my BlackBerry, I have my laptop, and I play an early morning round, go to the bar, I'm just going to have a drink. Well, the guy sitting next to me, we just start chatting. Well, he's a San Francisco police officer. He was cool as can be. He just got finished playing. Next thing you know, it's him and I just ratting every bar known to man, gone to the Artichoke Casino in South City. Like, I went to his house, parked my car. We went on a whole day bender. I have no idea where my car is. I just know it's somewhere along the railroad. He lived somewhere near the railroad tracks in South City, San Francisco. And I had to have my mother and father-in-law like go drive the neighborhood with me so I could find my company car the next day. You know what I mean? So it's it's cool to see both worlds and to know that we can recover from that. And that's the thing, like, I know that world. But I also know this world.
Yeah.
And it's and bridging that gap.
And you've identified now where you'd rather be. And what gives you happiness and what gives you that satisfaction.
Totally.
And it's amazing how it ties back in and to that word, the other word you said is the passion. You know, what's your passion? What are you passionate about? And generally when you're passionate about something, that gets you out of bed in the morning, gives you that positive approach. And one thing we see in this industry is the golf turf industry is that, and turf industry in general, is that people are passionate about what they do. One of my favorite things to do at home is mow the lawn, as you were talking about earlier. You know, like, you know, you've literally been working around golf, so you like to make it sure it looks nice, but there's nothing like that satisfaction as you're talking about, whether it's on a small scale of being your front yard or whether it's on the wider scale of being a golf course, of getting to the end of the job and just sitting back and going, yeah, I'm really happy with that. It looks good. And the pressures of the day seem to fade away.
Totally. And you say that, I remember mowing yards, and it was all St. Augustine for the most part in Metairie and New Orleans, Louisiana, that I was mowing. And I always looked at the baseball fields and I saw their stripes. And I'm just like, how do you do that? So I'd mow the patterns, I'd mow diamonds. But St. Aug doesn't, one, I didn't have a roller on the mower, had no clue that that's what did it. And then even if you did, the leaf blade doesn't, it just, the warm season, St. Augustine just doesn't stripe up. So you'd see my tire lines from the, you know, 22 inch walk behinds, and the neighbors would laugh because I was super passionate. I'd make sure it's just right and just perfect. And I knew nothing about it. I personally wanted it to look perfect. Yep. And then we'd drive by and be like, oh, that's my yard. That's my yard. And it's just a love that I just, like you said, I don't know what it is, but I love being able to manicure it and make it look just right.
Yeah.
And that's how I am on the golf course. And my guys, my assistants has learned how keen of an eye I have. I can tell you
that. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can spot things from a mile away. And a lot of that's learned at Pebble Beach. You know, prepping for tournaments and looking for the smallest detail, but we can do it. So why don't we do it?
Yeah.
And that's a cool thing that when you're working with turf, you can fix it pretty quickly.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt. And as I say, it's just that attention to detail, seeing things and being able to action it. But also I suppose it comes down to especially this theme we're talking about is not getting too caught up with it. At the end of the day, it's a living plant. Things are going to go wrong. You know, so many different factors that you need to take into in relation to looking after a piece of grass, let alone a whole golf course. So it's also being able to just take that step away and go, right, hey, it's not working. What do we need to do to fix it? And have that collaborative approach with your team as well. To be able to solve challenges, solve issues.
And that's one thing that I like. I love the parallel with the turf industry and of the sobriety world that I know. I know without a shadow of a doubt, I have the tools and the relationships in sobriety to get through absolutely anything. My personal trust in God and the process that I've learned in sobriety is absolutely unwavering. You can come at me with anything. As long as my relationship is strong with God, anything. I mean, anything. Now, the outcome's not going to be what I want, but I have the tools and I have the relationships in place that my perspective can be changed. I don't need to change the outcome. And I feel that we're the same. Granted, we're at a different level of budget when it comes to our courses. We're at the top. So we have a little bit more resources than maybe some other courses, you know, especially when you look at the bell curve of the golf courses across the country and the world. We're not in the bell curve. We're on the outskirts of it when it comes to our resources. But being able to identify things on the golf course and remedy it, we have all the tools. Now it's a matter of being patient. It's a matter of accepting what happened and not getting too emotional. And that's the same thing in life. Like, that's what I see when things happen. I used to say things happen to me. I don't think things happen to me anymore. When things happen, not getting too anxious about it, not getting too emotional about it. People are going to make mistakes. There's going to be guys on the crew that don't show up on time. There's going to be guys that just don't show up at all. There's going to be guys that have issues with drugs and alcohol. There's going to be superstars and rock stars that you never have to deal with. You know, there's going to be mistakes on the golf course. People are going to get hurt. People are going to damage equipment. How can we deal with that with grace and tact? And I think that is a cultural thing where when you set the tone to your crew that, look, we're trying to achieve perfection. That is what we're trying to do at our level. Are we going to achieve it? Let's be honest. No. We're going to get close sometimes, but we're never going to achieve it. We're also going to make mistakes along the way. I know from my experience, the mistakes that I've made along the way were the greatest learning tools that have ever happened to me. I've been so embarrassed and so mortified because I'm so hard on myself on making a mistake that it's not happening again. I'll share one with you. It is the Sunday of the AT&T Pro-Am, PGA Tour event every year at Pebble. This is my first year mowing fairways as an AIT. And we're knocking it out of the park. The whole week leading up to it, lines are great. They're burned in. They're looking beautiful. We're having some trouble on two fairway because we're starting so early. It's so dark. It's during the winter. And the media tent's right there. And there's a big old bright spotlight that even if you close your eyes, you can't get focused on the lines that you're mowing in the dark. So I changed my light on the last day, on Sunday morning. And I'm with a veteran that's been there for 20 years. So we're paired up. I'm supposed to be learning from him. And he's the old bull that's patient and gets out there slowly, lets time tick. He's going to totally get done before he needs to get done, but there's no reason to rush out there. I'm anxious. I'm going to rush out there. I decide to turn my mower lights off, which were halogen lights. And I have a new light on my head that's an LED light. If anyone knows when they're mowing in the dark with the stripes, if you change those two lights, it changes the colors of the stripes. So I start and I'm dead on throwing down lasers on the exact opposite lines. I pretty much wash it all out. It's too dark for me to see.
Yep.
My guy doesn't even say anything. We get going and the lead assistant's like, gets there as sun breaks. What happened, dude? And I'm absolutely mortified. We're on TV and I learned a lesson.
Yep.
I learned a valuable lesson. Luckily, that hole particularly isn't on TV. It's at the beginning of the course. It's not a picturesque hole. And they set it up that way for a reason. But I was anxious. I didn't follow the plan. You know, all these different variables that I decided to change on the last day, I can tell you that's not happening again. And most people would want to get upset with you, maybe get emotional, right? Cause already bad situation worse, which isn't going to help anyone. Mm. But if you're able to sit back and you've seen it a few times and you're able to be patient and you use it as a learning experience, the whole team's better for it. And no one's trying to run away. because so-and-so yelled at him or someone disrespected him. Now we get to laugh about it. And that's one big thing in sobriety. I have a different sense of humor than most. The darker, crazier stories that we get to share with each other in sobriety, when I know I'm looking at you and you've crossed the threshold and you're safe and you're thriving today, that makes that really bad, crazy story that much funnier to me. And we can laugh at how serious we took ourselves. And that just kind of it's like water running off a duck's back, right? We're not attached to that experience anymore. We're not allowing it to hold us down and keep us back and not grow. We are growing. We're getting better. We're able to share that vulnerable experience and show others that, hey, it's okay. Like, you're going to be better for this because of that. Now, granted, you have some situations where people don't learn through those experiences, and that's a different story, and that'll be managed differently. But when you got a high achiever that's trying to, you know, do his best, you don't need to throw any more gasoline on the fire. They'll take care of themselves mentally because they don't want to mess up. And I find that a lot with my long-term crew members, you know, trying to manage them, especially somebody that's an all-star. And I'm experiencing it, or I have experienced it with some, where it's just like they might have fell short in the details. And how do you coach them? Because they're stubborn and nope, I wasn't wrong. I get it. But like the result, it's not there. And we can do better.
Yeah. It is all about that acceptance at the end of the day, though, that, you know, and I think it was an important thing you said there, accepting what has occurred and being able to have the conversation about it. And it's whether it's in relation to the preparation of the golf course, accepting where you are and looking at a pathway, or accepting where you are personally and knowing that you need to make a change. That first step in any of that is accepting that either there's a mistake or there's a change or something that needs to occur to allow you to step forward. And the best thing to do that is just then have a conversation about it, whether it's as a team or as an individual. You know, the conversation about how you improve or how you get better or how you learn from something, because sometimes it's a real challenge to do that by yourself.
Yeah, and I find it very constructive to be able to speak with your team and share your mistakes. Mm-hmm. Let them know that, hey, I made this decision and it wasn't the correct decision. I own that.
Absolutely.
And that's okay. We're going to get better from that. And I do. I talk with my crew a lot. I share, probably overshare. And I feel the places that I've been prior. When you're not open and you're not vulnerable, it creates this compartmental situation. And it doesn't allow people to understand if you trust them, if you care for them, if you're invested in them. Yeah. I think the more we're able to be open, the more they understand that. And then all of a sudden the culture changes a little bit. Maybe they're become willing to be open with you. I see it right now. And I got to be careful how I speak, but there are team members through history that may have been passed up by others because they didn't want to manage them. They didn't feel that they had the skills, the talents, or whatever. So that you just go do this and we're going to forget about you. Hmm. Well, no, you're part of the team.
Correct.
We're going to get you up and running, and you're going to be on the same level as everyone else. I believe in you, and I'm going to help you. And I'm going to do everything in my power to get you up and running. And I understand that maybe you don't do certain tasks the same as the all-star, but we're going to get you there. And it's interesting to see everyone being blown away like, oh, wow, he's doing that. And then over time, all of a sudden, things change. And the guy, maybe that would always make the mistake and hide it. Now he's coming forthright and being like, hey, I made a mistake, making less mistakes, catching things, you know, being more aware on the golf course. And now the team's completely better for it. It was a lot of time and a lot of effort to put into it, but now the whole team is better. Yes, that individual is better, but now you're not hearing, you know, oh, so-and-so's lazy and he's not doing this. And it's just like, how much better can we be when you don't have to worry about that? Right. And it just takes more time, and it takes awareness, and it takes accountability. And that, I think that's the next thing outside of acceptance, is holding people accountable. It is extremely difficult to hold everyone accountable to a certain standard, especially when you're taking over an organization that maybe hasn't had accountability in a very long time. I'm extremely accountable to myself and to my peers. That bleeds over into my work. That bleeds over, and it's all aspects of my life. There's no compartments, you know. It's not like sobriety's here and, you know, personal life's here and work life's here. It's all aspects. And it's hard to change that culture because they think they're getting, what's the word? They're getting punished. And it's like, no, that's not what we're doing. We're bringing this to your attention to show you that we care and what can we do to improve, right? And if you're able to do that, now the golf course is doing better. You know, we're the best we've ever been because we're holding people accountable, and that's a tough one. You know, no one wants to get written up. No one wants to be in the boss's office multiple times. I certainly don't want to do it, but it's my duty. It's my responsibility. I'm going to hold you accountable. I'm going to make you a better person, whether you like it or not. Like, we're going to, either you don't want to be on the team or you're going to get better.
No doubt. And they're the conversations you need to have, because as you're saying, if you don't have those conversations, it has flow on effects across the whole team, because others are sitting back and saying, well, I'm doing my job. Why aren't they doing theirs? And it's all about that first understanding that you've got so many different people that make up a team, and you can't talk the same way to each one, because they have different ways of compartmentalizing or processing the information that you give it. So it does mean that a team leader needs to be able to have different conversations, same message, but delivered in a slightly different way to different people, to hopefully lift them up and know that they're a valued member, or find ways to improve them that allows them to be that better member of the team that then balances it out across the whole team. So it is about, you know, identifying, but at the first step, whether it's about yourself or about others, accepting, you know, but then having that conversation to look at how things can be improved.
Totally. And even the setting of the example in all different aspects, it's been interesting to see how people react to you and to others when the example's been set. I've gotten into fitness and dieting and everything in the last 6 to 10 months. And it's funny to see how setting that example of it can be done, there are certain people around you like, oh, well, I'm going to get into this. If he can do it, then I can do it. And I definitely find that that's an encouraging thing, to keep doing the right thing and keep challenging yourself, because it does have an impact on others. It can go either way. You can either all be the bar rats and go out and drink on Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, or, you know, hell, we got 4 or 5 guys now. We do cold plunges in the Pacific Ocean on the weekends. You know, we got pros from some of the golf courses doing it. We got superintendents and assistant superintendents doing it, all for health, right? And there's the positive effect that can be enjoyed by everyone as well. And it's very cool to see.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. I'm not sure cold plunges in the Pacific are for everyone, but that health, the health messaging though that comes out about what we do and how we, you know, can make sure our minds are available. There's nothing better than being able to be out and feeling good about what you're doing. We've all been there plenty of times where we've been out the night before and stayed up too late and done things we didn't need to. And there's certainly a feeling which you sit there and go, that's the last time I do that. Or for some people, they don't. They continue on doing it. But I think, you know, they always say healthy mind, healthy body at the end of the day has some, you know, it's just, they're just connected. And,
you know, we've had situations through my history where, you know, the guy makes it in on time, he's mowing, and, you know, he might take a step into the bushes to, you know, relieve himself from the night before, you know, a little puke and rally. Mm. And it's funny to even see the difference in that, in being able to coach people and be aware, right? Because we've had all walks of life. We've had the guys that were in that position that got to a breaking point and knew that there was help around, and now they're sober. And then there's guys that, you know, they had to be terminated. Mm. They weren't fit to work. And some of those guys have moved on and had great careers, and it was a great wake-up call. And some are still out there doing their thing. But they know where they can go to get help, you know, yep. And it's my responsibility to be aware of that and bring that to the surface instead of ignoring it.
So what can we be doing as an industry? Obviously what you're doing at the moment, we're talking about it today, but what more can we be doing as an industry to be able to, I suppose, provide people with the tools to have the conversation? Or is it a knowledge thing, or, you know, to be able to lead and make sure that, I suppose the other angle of that is, you know, providing those pathways for people who need to make a self-assessment, because as you said at the opening, you know, generally the person with the problem is the last to realize they've got a problem. So how can we be doing this as a turf industry to make sure that our people are well looked after?
I think this is a great start. I think being open about it and telling our stories, sharing our stories, especially the guys that have struggled and have overcome it, being able to allow people into their life, to know what's happened. Because there's all kinds of different walks of life. And I don't know that the turf industry is any worse than any other industry. Mm. It's funny when I hear like, oh, this industry and oh, this industry. Listen, there's doctors, there's ditch diggers, there's trust fund kids, you know, there's all kinds of walks of life that deal with this. But what I find with us is being able to be open and speak about the issues of what's going on. Right. Certain cultures, you know, you're strong, you're stubborn, it's weak to talk about your feelings. It's weak to share about what's going on at home. You just stuff that stuff down and you just get through it and just drink a little bit more and you can deal with it. So I think it's breaking the stigma and knowing that we all deal with some type of mental health issues. And across the board, we do nothing for it. I mean, there's initiatives that I know in the golf world where people stretch and they do different little exercises before they start in the morning for physical, you know, because they're sitting on a mower or anything like that. You know, there's aspects like that. We never meditate, you know, we never require anybody to do any introspective writing. I'm not saying that that is the answer by any means, but I'm saying that's the answer. You know, like, yeah. I don't think it's the jobs or the company's responsibility to instill that or make someone do that. But we're spending all this time in different aspects. You know, we look at nutrition, right? So we provide lunch for our guys and girls across the entire company. We're almost 3,000 strong. We have multiple cafeterias. And when it comes down to what we eat, we're looking at it and we're trying to provide healthier options, right? So we're looking at nutrition, right? We have all these gym memberships that we have discounts for, and we promote physical fitness, right? What are we doing for mental health?
Yeah.
Nothing. Scary. Yeah. No one wants to talk about it.
Yep.
No one. Unless you've been through a transformation like myself, where like, I'm confident in it. I know the process. It's been a decade for me. I understand the relationship that we need with it so that we can become free. How you do that, man. Solve that. I mean,
well, that's right. It's there's a whole lot of initiatives in the wider community, I suppose. Here in Australia, I don't know if it's over in overseas as well. It's, you know, there's an Are You Okay? The initials there, just to have that conversation with people to see how they're doing.
And you guys have Movember.
Correct.
So I'm a big proponent of Movember.
Well, you've got a magnificent array of facial hair anyway. For those that don't know what Movember is, it's a charity to talk about mental health and raising money by growing a moustache or not shaving. So you get sponsored. So that's what I'm saying. Mike here is an excellent proponent for that for Movember.
I actually grew a Fu Manchu that was like two inches below my chin, and I had dyed it because I dressed up as Hulk Hogan for Halloween 2 years ago and bleached it white and then kept it for the entire month of November, which we have a professional tournament at Pebble Beach during November. And I'm walking around. I believe I went on an interview or I had to do something publicly while I had it. And it's just like, you know, you're behind the scenes and people don't really say anything, but then you walk out and executives like, what is going on right now with your face? Well, that's the type of thing you get to explain and have a conversation.
Correct.
What Movember is really about. And, you know, for me at that time, I had three people commit suicide within a month and a half. A family member, a good friend, and, you know, somebody that we knew within the community. It's near and dear to my heart. Like I went down that road personally, you know, so those type of programs are huge. Are You Okay? In Movember, just to get people talking about it.
Yep.
It's unfortunate that that's what it takes. We got to talk about it as a department in golf when Grayson Murray committed suicide. Yes. He was best friends with our EVP, and our EVP was absolutely wrecked, and so was his little boy. And how do you explain it? It's the first time that he got to experience that, and we're sitting in a room with 12 men talking about our feelings and our shortcomings and our fears, and we got to talk about suicide before Grayson did that. Not a peep, right? You know, if one of your family members went down that road and gets committed, well, I'm not talking about it, because cancer is okay to talk about, but crazy is off limits, and no one wants to dare put their toe in that water, right? Because it's crazy. People have a stigma about it. Yep. And when you remove the stigma and you get to talk about it, it opens people's eyes and it changes people's perspective. I was in the gym yesterday working out with my neighbor, and I belong to the same gym. It's actually Spanish Bay. And I forget the topic we got on, but we were talking about how people, mainly children, are so insecure and they haven't been met with adversity. They haven't had to overcome things. They're out here in our community, a lot of entitled people, not even children, just people. They haven't had to struggle for anything. They haven't had to overcome anything. They have no confidence in themselves. So the littlest adversity just cripples them. And you find out how insecure and how fearful people are. And it's the people that I've learned that puff up their chest and try to act tough end up being some of the most insecure. And I have done a lot of volunteering in the prison system. And there was this one guy I came across. I forget the way you say it in Russian, but his nickname was the Enforcer. And he lived that lifestyle. He was down for life without parole. He was like 6'4 or 6'5, maybe 6'6. I mean, an absolute unit of a guy. Tattoos from the ears down to the fingertips. He was part of the Aryan Brotherhood. He had like SS tattoos on his hands, Hitler on his shoulder. And then you get to sit down with this guy. And this guy ends up opening up by doing some introspective writing. And you find out he may be the most insecure, fearful person I've ever spoke to. And you start doing this work and you're finding out like as much animosity and maybe even hatred for that person that I had. Now I have empathy for him. Like, could you imagine living your life and not knowing the joy of loving a child or being able to share your heart with your brother or your sister, your mom or your dad? And like the life that you live is that of legit crazy violence. And that's what your whole purpose is, because instead of sharing yourself and being vulnerable, you just stuff it down. And if someone brings it up, you take them out. And then it grows to where that's what you do. That's who you become. And it's like, is he evil or is he broken?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point you raise. It's the insecurity, and we see that now in modern society. I've got a couple of kids, and one's about to go turn into teenage life. And what we do see is the aspect of, and you mentioned this earlier back in the piece, of what is normal, you know, what is normally expected. And now there's a sort of new normal, and that new normal is to fly off the handle or to, I suppose, you know, whether it's violence or whether it's other anger or other things, that becoming a new normal that people try to or think is right, whether it's from a social media aspect or whatever the case may be. But we just need to return to say, well, hang on, you know, this is not a secure way to manage your life. We need to not look at others who are betraying things that we don't feel are right and get back to what it should be. A normal life of conversation.
And we've gotten into a situation where we try to treat the symptoms. You know, when we're talking about doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, you know, your family practice doctors. I mean, all these people gave me pills, and they thought they were doing what was right. Right? I can't sleep at night. I can't stop thinking about work. I can't. Well, here, take this. This will help you sleep. I get anxious. My heart beats out of my chest. I get to a point where I have a panic attack and I'm about to puke in the bathroom. Here, take this. This helps this. How about, what's the cause of it? Like, is it because you didn't prepare for work? Are you fearful that you're going to be embarrassed and you're going to fail? Like, what's the root causes of it? We can fix those root causes, but we need to speak about it. We need to be open about it, right? Why don't you come to me when you make a mistake on the golf course? Because you're embarrassed. Maybe you're fearful you're going to lose your job. Maybe you don't want to disappoint me, right? So what are those causes? Let's look at those causes and let me handle that in a way that I'm open and you can come and tell me and you can understand that, oh, it is okay. Like, I'm not embarrassed. Like, he took that well, right? But like, we need to be open and talk about it. Mm-hmm. Sure. And it's a difficult avenue to go down because there's people that don't want to talk about it. They don't want to, mm-hmm. You know, they're dealing with trauma. Got to really navigate this, but there's guys that I've worked with and you find out what's going on at home and you're like, well, no wonder he's acting the way he's acting, right? Like, he's got some big, big problems. What can we do to help, right? But I think doing things like this and putting it out there, I know this helps. I don't like putting out my past. The last podcast I did, my nephew found out that I did hard drugs. It was the first time he found that out. My brother was upset with me. But I'm pretty sure it saved a few lives.
Yeah.
So it sucks. Maybe I lose a job over it. Maybe I don't get a job because of it. Maybe I save a life because of it.
That's right.
Right. So my thing is let's worry about the life. A job will come and go. Right. But I've found over the years, the more I'm open, especially on a public level, people confide in you. And we're able to get them the help that they need. It has never looked the same when people have reached out, but we've pointed them in the direction that they needed to go and they're better for it. I just got a message, you know, as we're finalizing the magazine, a guy that I completely forgot about messaged me and he's 2 years sober today and couldn't be more grateful and thankful for me sharing my story because it gave him, and this guy's not in the turf world. This is a guy that I went to high school with that follows me on social media, but it was enough of a wake up call to him that he changed his life. And that's huge, right? Like, how can we do that on a daily basis to reach more people?
Yep. Exactly right. And that's through, as you say, having the conversation and, hopefully someone, and as you've mentioned, the article, there's an article coming out in Greenkeeping magazine in the next edition over in the UK, but we'll also be sharing across our website as well and other platforms. So please, you know, take the time. And that's what it's all about at the end of the day. To take a next step is just taking the time, taking that moment to be able to either sit back and listen or read something. Write something down, as you mentioned before, about how you're feeling and then how you can make some actions to get out of it. But that first step of taking a moment to look at yourself as well allows you to get onto a journey where satisfaction, passion, you know, acceptance, all these things start to move in the right direction. One of the other things we do, go and mow your front lawn and mow your neighbor's front lawn.
Right.
And look at the grass.
Absolutely. I've definitely found telling the stories. I share in the article how I do story time with my crew. I find that me being vulnerable and sharing stories, just random stories of the past, even you know, current stories. It's a form of entertainment. It's a way to help people think. It's definitely a route to what I grew up with, but it gets your mind moving and thinking, and you relate, you identify, maybe you don't identify, but it creates an environment where it's just easier to be able to open up and share.
Absolutely. I think that's the biggest thing that we can take out of a conversation today is to share. You know, if you're feeling like something is getting on top of you, talk to someone. Or if you think something's getting on top of someone, whether it's in your team or outside of your team, talk to them as well. Ask them if they're okay. Is there anything we can help them with? And that's that first step in relation to, you know, helping someone out who may have some issues with either sobriety or mental health or something else going on in their life, because life can get complex at times. And we've just got to be able to ask people, you know, how they're doing. Can we help? What can we do to help you? And sometimes that is always the hardest step, but one that we need to do.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those situations where we used to say, when you see something, say something. Have the uncomfortable conversation. Yep. When you see a team member or a family member, call them out. Worst case scenario, you're wrong and they think you're crazy. Yep. I'd rather be called crazy and potentially save your life than to not love you at all and just let you, you know, fall to the wayside and not be able to live life.
Exactly. Well, Mike, I've taken up a lot of your time today. It's been wonderful to have a conversation with you, and I look forward to having another one at some point in the near future. Appreciate everything you're doing out there and raising awareness and having those conversations. We haven't even really touched on what you're doing at Del Monte and in the Pebble Beach Resorts, but I'm sure
we'll
it's going
to
be
a,
nice.
A series two.
We will. I look forward to a series two. Mike Noel, thank you very much. As I said, if you get the opportunity, please do have a look, read the article with Mike that we'll be pushing out as well. But the best thing that you can do is do something to start the conversation. Mike, thanks again for your time.
Absolutely, Nick. I appreciate you. And thank you to True Turf for bringing the human aspect into to their equipment world.
It's our pleasure. Something we love to do. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.